A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 20, 1997, in the series Tough Questions, No Easy Answers, entitled What Lies Beyond Death's Veil. The texts for the sermon are Romans 8, verses 9 through 25, and Luke 20, verses 27 through 38. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
So what lies beyond death's veil? That's a tough question. And there's no easy answer. And that is precisely the series that we are engaged in during these summer weeks. Tough questions, no easy answers. Tough questions in the sense that they are questions that arise out of the core of our human being. They are the questions that arise because we are human. They are the questions that make a difference how we live and how we die. They are urgent, existential questions. They are the questions that come to us in the middle of the night and in those moments of awareness. Tough questions that have no easy answers. And our endeavor as we address these tough questions is not to find an easy answer. It is rather to clarify the question, to understand the question. Because unless we understand the question, we can identify its source and its meaning, we may have answers, but we will not have a place to stand, an answer that is really the expression of our own internal confidence and faith and certainty. What lies beyond death's veil? That is perhaps the core question of the core questions, and it is those questions that have provided the origin for religion. Religion is a universal phenomena. The anthropologists who have scoured the earth and studied the most advanced societies and the most primitive and backward tribes tell us that the human person is a religious animal. Religion is universal because religion arises to deal with the questions that arise because we are human. Questions that we cannot avoid because we are human. What lies beyond the veil of death? It comes to us because as human beings we have arrived at a point in the unfolding evolutionary development of the cosmos that we are creatures who have consciousness, self-consciousness, and awareness. When I married Nancy 25 years ago, I inherited a Siamese cat that I never really got acquainted with, and a poodle that I learned to love. Oh, and three kids that weren't too bad either. But Topaz, the apricot standard poodle, developed kidney problems and euthanasia was in order. And then, in order to fill the gap, along came Midnight, the black standard poodle. He was a lovely fella, although emotionally retarded. But we loved him as a handicapped canine. He too came to the end of his days and he died in his grandmother's arms, Nancy's arms, I should say. And we gave him a proper burial in the sand dune behind our house. And then, of course, in order to fill that void, along came the chocolate standard poodle named Hershey. Now, Hershey has neither physical defect nor emotional problem, except that he refuses to admit that he's growing older and he still acts like a puppy. He has grand, wonderful brown eyes. I love him very much. I think he has some learning possibilities, maybe even a grain of intelligence. He certainly has a personality. And there are times when he looks at me and I say to him, "What would you like to say to me? It seems like you just want to tell me something." But one of the things that he has never done, nor did Midnight, nor did Topaz, Hershey has never focused those big brown eyes on me and said, "Pastor, I will die one day. And what is the meaning of it all?" He is totally oblivious to the fact. Dogs don't think about death. Dogs never call a canine conference to discuss suffering and the anguish of the canine situation. And dogs breathe their last, and it's over. And they have not had a shred of fear or even consciousness of its inevitability. Not so with us. We live before the reality of death. We are those creatures who have developed to the point at which we can jump out of our skin and look at ourselves and look at another. We can relate interpersonally and we can reflect upon ourselves from a point beyond ourselves. And we recognize the fact that we are mortal and that we will die. And so, in the origins of religion, we have the response to those deep core existential questions, at the core of which is the question of what lies beyond death's veil. Nothing or something more? And it is that awareness that drives us to wrestle with that question. And religions arise to provide answers. But religions have a tendency, I would almost say an inevitable tendency, to become regularized and formalized. Starting with a deep existential need, eventually there evolves a catechism. And then we have questions and we have answers. And the questions may be the right questions, and the answers may be the right answers, but now it's become more of an academic and intellectual process. What's the question? This is the answer. It's almost like those jokes you can tell when you're in a group that tells them over and over again. You don't have to tell the joke. You say, "Number 92, and everybody laughs. What's the question? Oh, yes, and that's the answer. But no longer is that arising out of a deep center within us. And then one day we stand before our physician and he says, "You are terminally ill. You have 6 months to live." Or the love of our life is suddenly snuffed out. And then the question again becomes urgent, and the religious quest becomes serious, because down deep we need to know. Why are we here? Why do we die? What does it mean? Is there nothing, or is there something more? Universally, just as humankind is universally religious, so universally, until the 19th century, all peoples everywhere answered affirmatively, "There is something more." And I could, this morning, end right now by simply proclaiming the Easter faith, the Christian answer. But we are looking at the questions in this series, not simply to reiterate what the tradition says, not simply to make some dogmatic proclamation, but to wrestle with a question in the light of a whole new world that confronts us. And we really have to do that if we would be on the cutting edge and engage those people who have simply drifted away because their human experience no longer connects with that traditional answer. And somehow or other, the institutional form of the church, all of that has lost its meaning and its grip on them. And they are out there drifting along, but not without questions and not without spiritual hunger, I think. And if we would engage them, and if we would address them again, then we have to ask those questions. Even though we know the traditional answer, we have to ask those questions in the light of a whole new world. Because up until 100, 150 years ago, no one questioned that there was something more. But our 20th century has been shaped by the development of modern atheism in the 19th century, and it was an intellectual movement that has shaped the minds of those who think and lead and shape society, and it has created the spiritual crisis of the 20th century, a crisis to which the church has simply affirmed its dogma rather than engaging and wrestling with a new world, finding a way to translate the faith and say the same thing differently. Ludwig Feuerbach was a Protestant pastor's son who studied to become a theologian and became eventually a philosopher. You've heard me mention his name before because he is so key to the whole development of the modern conception of things, spiritual things. Feuerbach was the one who said, "There is no God," as counterpoint to our worship, to our prayers. God is the projection of the human person, the idealized person, projected out on the screen of reality, becoming then the source and the solace for all of our human need. Feuerbach. God is projection. That is the most serious critique that can be brought against religion, because it says religion is a human phenomena, period, created out of human needs, period, with nothing to correspond to that God figure. It is simply a projection. Taking that assumption on critically was Karl Marx, who went on to look at history and saw it as a history of exploitation. And he saw the function of religion as drugging the masses, as the opium of the people, keeping the natives from growing restless, keeping them down, sort of drugged in their oppression. He saw the story of history as the oppressors and the oppressed, and religion as the function of keeping the oppressed in their place, promising pie in the sky out there in order to compensate for the hell that was here and now. Sigmund Freud took it from another angle. Once again, uncritically embracing Feuerbach's claim of God as projection, Sigmund Freud said, from the psychological point of view, all of religion, all of our ritual, our worship, all of that is illusion. Is illusion. And that whole train of development from the European continent culminated in Friedrich Nietzsche, the nihilist, who in Thus Saith Zarathustra, "God is dead, we have killed him," who said in another place, "There is no truth, everything is permitted." And he said that at the very end of the 19th century. And it was like a prophecy over the 20th century, which sums up the cultural, the spiritual cultural crisis which has shaped our society and our lives. Richard Friedrich Elliot has written in The Hidden Face of God, Nietzsche's breakdown, because he did go insane, because he did not delight in his insight, his nihilism. He despaired of it. But he faced it. And facing it, he went mad. And Friedman says Nietzsche's breakdown and the elements that it reflected really does fit as symbolically expressing a culture's breakdown, or at least its arrival at a critical turning point. And at the summit of that culture was its God. And he goes on to speak about all of the developments of the modern period, the printing press, the Copernican Revolution, Galileo, Darwin, the growing power of the state over against the church and the loss of authority in the church, biblical criticism, and the gradual authority of God in human affairs. That is the world that we in the 20th century inherited from the 19th century, whose answer to this ultimate question was, what lies beyond death's veil? Nothing. It is in the light of that world, that context, that social reality, that cultural milieu, it is in that framework that we must raise the question anew, what lies beyond death's veil? That's not mine. In 1983, when I was going to the University of Michigan for the seminar with Hans Kung, he was giving lectures, Eternal Life? And he raised all of these ultimate end questions in the light of a new world. He said, the turning point to the modern age, the deepest incision in the time after the birth of Christ, the dual Copernican turning point from earth to the sun, and at the same time from God to the human being, has to be taken seriously. That is to say, we are raising the question of eternal life at a time when a completely new scientific world vision has come to prevail, and the blue outer wall of the heavenly halls as the scene of eternal life has begun literally to dissolve into thin air. Well, he goes on, but I won't. It's a great quotation. This new world, this reality that we are trying to come to terms with in our own understanding of cosmic development, this new world is the world in which I raise the question. Because like I said, I could affirm that there is something more, but I've done that for 30 Easters here. You know that. And you know what the traditional answer is. But can we say it with intellectual integrity and the passion of faith in light of all that we know, without simply quoting our authority or affirming our dogma? Does it still make sense in the light of the reality that we live and in which we live? We do know the biblical affirmation. Jesus And a rather interesting use of that Moses burning bush story said, God is the God of the living, or all are alive to God. And he took that from Moses' statement, his calling God, Yahweh, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, those ancient patriarchal figures, even in Moses' day, Jesus says, Moses spoke of them as in the present, which could only mean as in the presence of God. And thus he put to rest that Sadducean savage attack of the poor woman who had to endure seven brothers. If I'd been rabbi at the time, I would have said to about the third brother, I wouldn't try it. And Paul has an interesting way of combining the future hope with cosmic reality. He says the whole creation is groaning in labor pains, waiting to give forth, to enter into that glorious freedom of the children of God. It's like all of nature is waiting for our full redemption to join in that freedom from the bondage of decay. Now, don't hear me say that Jesus and Paul understood 20th century cosmology, because they certainly didn't. In fact, Paul's paradigm is the paradigm that I rejected last week, the creation fall redemption paradigm. Rather cheeky of me to argue with Paul, isn't it? I'm sorry, folks, he was wrong. But what about that new model we were experimenting with, that emerging model, which has the inorganic level and the organic level and the human conscious level and the spirit level, which is that movement of energy coalescing into matter through a duration of time and an expansion of space. What about that model? Can we say something about that which lies beyond death's veil in light of that model, which speaks of an emergence of a cosmic reality that is shot through with the Spirit of God, that is alive with the breath of God, that flows out of the God as mystery and flows into shalom, spirit, God as source, guide, and goal of all that is, Paul's doxology. I could use that doxology in the light of the latest information about the nature of the cosmic reality. And not because I can say that in the light of the latest information from the cosmologist, because it will change tomorrow and next decade and next century. But today, when I confess my faith, am I able, in the light of the best knowledge I can have, still to say, beyond death's veil, there is not nothing, but there is something more? I think I can. So breathe a sigh of relief. I think I can. For who is to say that an unfolding development full of wonder, enough to take our breath away, which has moved from inorganic to organic, to conscious life, to spiritual transcendence, who is to say that having arrived with us, this is all there is and there's no other place to go? Who is to say that we who have come to the point at which we can reflect on this, think about this, wonder at this, who is to say that when we breathe our last, there is no exit into some broader, grander plane? Who is to say? To say it would be to say it as an affirmation of faith fully as much as to say, as I said a moment ago, something more. I like the modesty with which Hans Küng answers in the affirmative, something more. What lies beyond death's veil? Not less, but more. And I want simply to make a couple of comments in closing, the first of which is, having affirmed that, I don't want you to get all focused on it. That's where the church has been focused for 20 centuries, to the denigration of this present existence, to the failure to celebrate this earth and this cosmos, to the failure to put the focus and the importance on this present moment, this present life, which is to be lived fully, richly, fully alive to the wonder of each moment. No, God is not out there. God is in here. God is here and now. Jesus said, this is eternal life, that they might know you, the only true God. And Jesus was not saying in some future moment. Jesus was saying, this is eternal life. Here and now is eternal life. Eternal life is living in the conscious presence of God. Eternal life is living in the sense of the mystery of God. Eternal life is to live filled with the Spirit of God, enlivened by the breath of God, living in wonder and adoration. That is eternal life, and it is here and it is now. And that makes death a moment of transition on the way of a continuing journey. For again, God is the one before whom all are present, and we move not into darkness and nothingness, but continue to move through death to God, mystery of the beginning and hope of our ending. And then this too. I force you to think a bit about these things. But finally, I want you to find a place to stand, because these are matters of the heart. And while I do not believe that it serves God or humankind well to make dogmatic declarations in the face of what we know, let me be clear that what we are speaking about is something more than we can know. What we are speaking about is finally that passionate, rest, deep trust in God that ought not to be affirmed in the face of the best knowledge available, but when that has been wrestled with, then one still awaits the commitment of the heart. If we have wrestled through as far as we can Then it is possible to find that simplicity on the other side of complexity, which is a confidence that there is not nothing, but something more. Not less, but more. And that ultimately, all will be well.